My name is Greg McQueen, and I'm a fourth semester multimedia design and communication student from Aarhus Business Academy in Denmark. Welcome to Trends Media for the Rest of Us, an audio documentary exploring the creation and use of trends media in our daily lives. This documentary is based on a series of podcasts entitled Trends Media for the Rest of Us, which you can find at trendsmediafortherestofus.posterous.com. This documentary would not have been possible without the assistance of the following people: Julian Phillips, Joanna Penn, T.L. Tyson, Mark Prensky, Mark Rock, Roger Overall, and Jody Cleghorn. The music is Hum by Gablay. Links to contributors are included in the notes alongside this audio production. Since the invention of the telephone by Alexander Graham Bell in the late 1800s, technology has transformed how we communicate. A microphone and speaker attached to a system that allowed point-to-point communication over short and long distances quickly spawned the birth of radio and radio broadcasts, one person or a few people talking to many. Fast forward to the age of social media, and we have many people talking to many other people in a constant stream of text, photos, audio, and video. It's what Henry Jenkins, a professor of communication, journalism, and cinema arts at the University of Southern California, calls convergence culture.
Everyone is potentially a producer of media as well as a consumer of media. A world where sharing with each other what we create is mutually rewarding and has enormous emotional satisfaction. We can go back through the last 200 years of human history and see people have always struggled with the limits of the technology to figure out a way to share their ideas with each other and to communicate effectively across geographic distances. Middle of the 19th century, teenagers were taking toy printing presses where they had to set the type letter by letter and printing out zines, and the American Amateur Press Association goes back to the Civil War era. These things were circulating on the national scale, you know, in the middle of the 19th century. That's the same impulse that leads kids today to put content up on their Facebook page, to just put something out on YouTube, to make their own song vids or whatever. That desire to create and share what you create with others is really, really powerful.
There's no revelation in the fact that we were artists, writers, video makers, photographers, and musicians well before the internet and platforms like YouTube simply gave us another opportunity to share what we were already doing. And the technology that allows us to share has changed to the point where sharing media is seamless. For example, sharing media to Twitter is now an integral part of Mac OS X. And the tools to make media on the Apple platform, such as GarageBand, iMovie, iWeb, iPhoto, are also now part of the Mac ecosystem. It doesn't stop there. iPhones, iPads, smartphones, and other portable devices come with cameras and microphones built in, as the following soundbite from a recent video made by Apple about the iPad 3 proves: the software needed to edit and share the media captured on these devices is also simply part of the system.
We believe technology is at its very best when it's invisible. When you're conscious only of what you're doing, not the device you're doing it with. An iPad is the perfect expression of that idea.
In reality, finding the tools to create content and platforms to share that content is no longer an issue. However, creating the right kind of content, content that conveys the right kind of message and speaks to an audience, is, and has always been, the most important issue. Why? Because while the tools have changed, while the reasons we share might have changed, creating content that speaks to the people we wish to share it with takes us right back to the days of Alexander Graham Bell and that crazy-looking box that was just a microphone and a speaker attached to some wires. Point-to-point communication. These days, it isn't just a voice on a line. It's photos, videos, audio, and text. It's transmedia. One to many. And thanks to the internet, we are each and every one of us transmedia producers, some more than others, and for many different reasons. Transmedia in all its forms is unmuting and transforming the web as we know it. However, at its core, transmedia is still point-to-point communication. Talk to me. I'm listening. Just as long as what you have to say holds my attention.
I think it's a term that has come along to sort of define content that takes place on more than television or on multiple platforms. Once upon a time, it used to be called multi-platform. At least that's what I knew it as. And then transmedia came along and it sounded like, okay, they're sort of reinventing the wheel here by calling it transmedia, but I can see that transmedia is a way of shorthanding how you create content that has more than one home. I'm assuming also it means that no one part of that media is subordinate to another. They're all integral and they're all important, and they all serve to tell a story using their own core functionality as opposed to just doing it for the hell of it.
That was Julian Phillips, a multi-platform producer for the BBC, with his definition of transmedia. Let's define it further by using one of Julian's projects as an example. Long Way Round was a television documentary series from 2004 that followed actors Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman as they rode on motorcycles from London to New York, a journey of 12,000 miles across Europe, Russia, through Canada and North America.
We're at the Eurostar. We've been very kindly given this sort of club lounge place. And then over here is Ewan and I and the lovely lady who has helped us along.
Lovely lady.
So what do you reckon, Ewan?
Well, listen, I really can't quite, but I had moments coming down there where I would suddenly remember that I wasn't just riding down the road, I was going on this world trip. I was having a moment then, talking about your smart.
Ewan's GPS is already broken, right? And it's 12 o'clock on the first day of our journey. I've fallen over twice.
You know, when we get to the other side of the tunnel, the next kind of... we're heading to Siberia on our motorbike.
As well as the television series, the BBC produced DVDs, books, a website, and even during filming, Ewan and Charlie blogged and posted photos and videos of their experiences on the project's website and on social media platforms. You can relive their journey at longwayround.com, which acts as a central hub for all the media produced for the project. What defines this project as a transmedia project, rather than simply a television documentary series, is the range of media produced for the project and the diversity of platforms used to distribute it: television, radio and print, and social media and the internet. Visiting the project's website leaves you with no doubt that each part of the project is equally as important as the other. And this illustrates Julian Phillips' definition of transmedia perfectly, that no single part of a transmedia project is subordinate to another. But what of transmedia for the rest of us? We don't all have the kind of resources available to organisations as large as the BBC. However, as I mentioned in the introduction to this programme, finding ways to share content across multiple platforms is now built into the very tools we use in our daily lives. That leads us right back to the real issue: creating engaging content that is meaningful to its audience. Whether it's video, photos, audio or text, finding ways to share content is simply a matter of choice. However, finding out how to produce content that's worth sharing in the eyes of its audience, that's the real challenge of producing compelling transmedia. In the rest of the interview with Julian Phillips, he shares his experiences of convincing traditional television producers of the value of transmedia and his thoughts on how the rest of us can become transmedia producers.
So I work with TV companies who want multi-platform content to make their TV production a little bit bigger or tell more of a story that they haven't got time to tell on television. And what I find is that people are beginning to learn now that they can let go of their content and put it out online earlier, rather than saying, but this is the crown jewels, I need to keep it for my television programme. If people see it before it goes on TV, they won't see it in the right way, and therefore it'll lose its impact, and then my programme will suffer for it. There is still that sort of thinking, but I think it's been broken down by the fact that people are doing interesting things with TV content and getting it out there and raising awareness and getting people interested in that programme content idea. And then what actually happens is that the content, that stuff that I call content, TV guys can look at it as marketing. And as long as you have that transaction in place, they tend to say, all right, well, okay, let's see how it works. And I've got plenty of examples of producers saying, I think I get it now. I think I get that if I let go of the content that I am preciously guarding at the moment, because I think it's can only be transmitted on TV, if I let it go onto multi-platform online, then I'm kind of creating an audience for it, and they're still hungry enough to have the main feast on TV. I suppose the bit that I think is still relevant is, if you have an idea 10 years ago, you would have that idea and you'd have to talk to people about it, and it probably, you know, where would you do that talking, where would you do the propagating of your idea, where would you get people interested in your idea? And now everything, the barrier to entry for everyone is so much lower that it costs you nothing to talk about what it is that you want to do and meet people that might be able to help you by going on Twitter or Facebook or any social network. So I don't think there's any problem for you to create a noise about your program, or not your program, but about your content. It's just that you can't expect the same amount of buzz to happen around, you know, that if you don't have a TV program. Having said that, though, all the stuff that I've done has been before the program's turned up. So actually, up until the point at which the program turns up, you can use the same tools. The eternal question is funding and where you're going to get the funding from. But I suppose the good news about that is that everything has become so much cheaper to make. It really is down to the quality of the idea. And you know, the one cost that you may have is, if you can't build web, if you can't build websites, interactive websites that actually are sort of more than just let's have a look at it and read something and then go away, then that may be a cost that you have. But you've got the camera, you know, you've got the microphone, you could make a movie. So you just need to find other multi-platform tools, like online build tools, and then that's getting easier. So if you are a multimedia student, then I shouldn't think you have anything in your way, except the age-old problem, which everybody has, is how am I going to get hold of money to make this work? And there has to be somebody that you can go to, and it seems like in Denmark there are more people you can go to talk about transmedia than you can in the UK even. So I would say that it's all about the idea.
We live in a culture where we have learned that creating and sharing content can actually help us manage our lives. Keeping in touch with our loved ones, staying up to date with work colleagues, or even allowing strangers to feed us news and information that's valuable to us from wherever they are in the world via RSS feeds and platforms like Twitter and Facebook. This opens up opportunities for content creators to become valuable sources of information for others. Author, blogger, speaker, and entrepreneur Joanna Penn is a perfect example of someone who has become a valuable source of information for others. Over the past 3 years, she has built a business out of researching and creating content and sharing it across multiple platforms. She has her own website, thecreativepen.com, where she shares the creation of podcasts, videos, blog posts, multimedia learning courses, ebooks, and printed books. The site is aimed at a specific target audience, people who are interested in writing, publishing of all kinds, and the promotion of those publications in all their formats. It is content that Joanna creates and publishes herself, using the kind of tools and platforms that are available to anyone with access to the World Wide Web. When did it all first start? I mean, well, what came first? Kind of the writing or the media production? Or how did it all kind of start, and how did it all come together?
I was an IT consultant, so you know, business consultant with Accenture and some of those bigger management consultancies. And I guess I hit sort of 33 and was like, oh, this is, I'm just, you know, wasting my life, blah blah blah. So I decided to write a book, my first book. I always wanted to write a book, you know, but I decided this time I would really do it, and it would be about career change. And in the process of investigating it, I would actually change my own career, find out what I really wanted to do, that type of thing. And I'm actually about to re-release that book. It's called How to Love Your Job or Find a New One. But basically, I wrote that back in 2007, ended up self-publishing it in 2008, and sold zero copies of that book. So then I was like, okay, so what's wrong with this picture? You know, I'm a highly educated person. I've done the best I can with the book. I've had it professionally edited. What's going on? And I discovered I knew nothing about marketing at all. No marketing or sales experience. So I went on this big sort of 6-month kick of learning everything I could about marketing. Plus, I was living in Australia, a country of 20 million people. So I really wanted to aim at America, 260 million people. So I decided that I would look at online marketing. So when I started to learn about online marketing, I sort of discovered podcasting and blogging. So I'm sure some people, you know, maybe you know Yaro Starak from Entrepreneur's Journey, but he has a great blog, and I did his blogging course, started the blog, started to share what I learned, and then I started the podcast in order to add multimedia in a way, but also so I could interview people like this and essentially learn from them. So I would learn, but also I would have something to put out there. And I love listening to audio, as many people do. So that was kind of the start. I got into all of this because I had a book that wasn't selling. And from there, it's just kind of snowballed since.
From starting to do that to really starting to get a following, and how long would you say it took before people really started to pick up on what you were doing online?
I think it probably took a year before of the blog before I started getting any, you know, real attention in terms of comments and traffic. But I really think it took, and I'm at just over 3.5 years now, probably it was two years before it would be considered decent traffic. And I've only, you know, I only went full time as an author entrepreneur last October. So coming up to 3 years full time blogging, podcasting, video production, everything. So it was always my aim to make it a full time thing, but it took a long time to build. So I would say people have to keep it going for like at least a year. But also I think to remember is that's why you've got to choose a topic that you're passionate about or that you are really interested in. Because as I said, I do the podcast and videos and stuff because I'm learning. So it doesn't matter what the result is because I'm still enjoying it and it's not a chore. I think that's really important.
Let's talk a little bit about the different things that you do, because of course you blog, so that's text, you make a podcast. You've also, when did you start producing videos? Was that quite early on or?
No, that was probably about 18 months after the podcast. And I think the main reason why is I was reading some of the top blogs, and they were talking about how video was coming. I think it was when Google bought YouTube, and basically the view was that because YouTube was the number two or the number one search engine, depending on the day, and that Google had this technology that was going to do voice recognition, which meant that you were going to start ranking for keywords that you were talking about, not just that were in a blog post. And I thought, well, why not get into this? And also being an author, so mainly I'm a fiction author, not many authors put their face out there. Most of them are kind of shy introverts, and I'm an introvert, but not that shy. So I thought I would try it. And of course, it's very hard to start. But now I do interviews, and most of them are video. So I don't use a mic anymore for the podcast. So I do the video interview like this. Then I turn the video into the audio, which I use in the podcast. And then I get, at the same time, I get a video, a 30, 40 minute video, which some people say are too long, but they're getting traffic. So yeah, I guess, so 18 months after audio.
Okay. One of the things which I really think defines what people are calling our transmedia producer is that everything they do has equal status.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I think is important for people to remember, and what I found and what I've been surprised about, is that there is a different audience in each of those areas. Now, of course, some people go between Twitter and the blog, but there are few people who read my text posts who also listen to the podcast, and there are people who listen to the podcast who would never watch a video or who would never visit my blog. Like, for example, I have 15% of my podcast listeners are in China, and I think it's only about 2% of my text posts are in China. They do have equal importance, because they that may be the way that somebody finds you, is through one of those things. So they all have to be really good, and they serve different purposes as well. Like I said, for SEO, as far as I know, a podcast, the audio file of a podcast, there is no way that can be indexed by Google, because that's, you know, like a file on your site. So I write a text post that has key phrases in so that can be indexed, but the podcast itself goes out on iTunes and all the other podcatchers. So yeah, I think they're very different medium for different audiences.
I think some people would say, you know, becoming a transmedia producer is all very well, but it takes a lot of time. You know, you need to find time for writing, and then you need to produce a podcast. You know, you've already described how you you do your interviews on video, and then you split up the audio and the video, which I think is a really smart thing to do, actually. But how do you divide up your time? Make sure you've got time to do everything.
It's very hard, even now. I mean, up to last October, so I did the podcast for 2.5 years, pretty much working full time and everything else. And it was hard. But, you know, as I said earlier, it's stuff I'm passionate about. And I would often, because I was in Australia, I would often do interviews at 5 a.m. Australia time, which was a decent time in America, decent time in England. Basically, it's about priorities. And let me also say what the podcast does for me in terms of traffic and business. First of all, if you spend half an hour with someone, especially on video, face to face, we form much more of a personal connection than we do if we just are on Twitter, or even just when we were on the phone, where, you know, now we can see each other. So for me, spending half an hour on the phone with some kind of mover and shaker in my industry is really good for me, because it banks up that social karma. At some point, you know, we can all call on each other and, you know, ask for favors that are within the scope of our friendship. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's about give and take. It's a very generous community. I also provide, you know, I can get content which gives me traffic to my blog. The person I'm interviewing will generally promote it on their site. So you get all of these different benefits from that one thing. That if I write a text post, the only benefit I get is that my followers read a text post and that I get some Google SEO. But it doesn't compare to the immense amount of other stuff you get from this type of interaction. So I think it's a case of making time for it. And I tend to have a podcast once every week or once every 2 weeks. Now I'm scheduled out to July. We're in April. So, you know, I'm always scheduled a few months in advance with all the interviews. So yeah, it's more about what's important. And for me, cultivating relationships is important.
How do you actually find content? I mean, most of what you do, I guess, you know, media-wise, is interviews with people. How do you find the people? And you know, how do you kind of find things to talk about with them?
Mostly it's Twitter, and it's people I already have met on Twitter and have a relationship with through Twitter. It's my kind of number one source. So for example, yesterday somebody tweeted me and said, actually, how do I make a podcast? So I tweeted them back an article that I wrote about how to make a podcast, and then she tweeted me again and said, wow, that's brilliant. And I clicked on her profile, and this is how Twitter works. you know this. Once people interact with you, you click on their profile. And I discovered that she's an expert in world religions, religious studies, religion and politics. And I have a master's in theology. I'm a total nut about religion. And my books are based around kind of religious stuff. So kind of, you know, Dan Brown meets Lara Croft action adventure. But so I emailed her and said, look, I'd love to interview you about how authors can use religion in their books while being sensitive, but also also in politics. And I mean, that's a fascinating topic. And then another guy emailed me and said, look, I've been following your blog. It's really great. I'd like to give something back to you. I'm a Canadian Mountie homicide investigator, forensic specialist. Is there any way I can help you? And I'm like, sure, I'd love to have you on my podcast to talk about what authors get wrong with forensics. I mean, that's brilliant. So essentially, I think this starts to snowball. You know, when you're starting out, you have to just ask people. And most people will, most people want to talk about themselves for half an hour or an hour, which, like, you've asked me and I've said, yeah, of course. So most people will say yes. And then... And then from there, you just organise it.
So would you say the key for you is, I mean, you're very passionate about a particular subject, which is writing, but it sounds, even if you find people to interview and talk to and content that's a little bit outside of that field, you always find a way to tie it into, you know, your core passion.
Yeah, I think that's critical for anyone online. You have to have your niche. And my niche is writing, publishing and book marketing. So I do that whole gamut. Basically, but yeah, so anything that I can bring in. So I just did an interview last night with an Amazon number one best-selling author who we talked about metadata on Amazon and how to use the description box and things like that. So that's marketing. But essentially, I think you can twist anything to any niche as well. But I will never just do something that's promotional. So it has to give value to my audience. And then it can be promotional for the person involved as well, because they get to talk about it.
If you were to kind of travel back in time to when you first started and visit yourself, what's the one big piece of advice you'd give yourself about producing this kind of stuff?
Well, it's funny. I look back and I think I haven't stopped podcasting. And I think, you know, advice to people is don't stop if you enjoy it. So I'm at 126 episodes right now, and I've got like 120 odd videos as well on YouTube. So by producing something every week, you build up a pretty big backlist. And what I'm finding now is people are finding me and they are downloading all 126 episodes. And you think of as somebody who is putting themselves out there looking for an audience. If people are downloading that much, that's like 60 hours worth of listening to my voice.
Well, you have a lovely voice.
Oh, thank you. Well, me and all my guests. But people really feel like they know you, and they send emails that say, you know, I feel like I'm your friend. And that's just brilliant. That's, you can't do that with a text post. So I'd probably go back and say to me, it's worth it, you know, hang in there, keep on going, and you will get better at this, because it was pretty bad at the beginning.
What does Joanna's example demonstrate about creating and sharing content and becoming a valuable source of information for a target audience? Joanna became a content creator because she needed to find out more about the world of book marketing. She identified her own need for that specific information and pinpointed the needs of a target audience seeking the same kind of information. By doing so, Joanna's own research became a form of transmedia marketing, and she has become a valued source of information for others. Joanna's example is also evidence that finding a target audience isn't limited to a content subject. By taking content and spreading it across multiple platforms, Joanna has managed to find audiences who are only interested in consuming her content through specific forms of media. One of the earliest forms of online media creation was text-based blogging, which started in the late 90s. However, blogging has quickly evolved from simple text-based diary entries to media of all forms: photo blogging, podcasting, video blogging, or vlogging. With the growing popularity of YouTube, which was launched in 2005, the popularity of video blogging has risen with equal measure. According to YouTube's own statistics, 60 hours of video are uploaded every minute, or 1 hour of video every second. Over 4 billion videos are viewed each day, and over 800 million users visit the site each month. While all these facts and figures are significant, an individual's reasons for starting a video blog are as unique as their needs to create and share content.